Radio.
Repairing Faith, Hope and Love. A talk by Professor Tracy Rowland.
Thank you very much, Peter. Ladies and gentlemen and fellow members of the Order of Malta. In theological parlance, faith, hope and love are known as the theological virtues. Faith is especially related to the intellect and to the intellect's pursuit of truth. Hope has a special relationship to the faculty of the memory and its experience of beauty. And love has a special relationship to the human will and its appetite for goodness. Since all of creation has been marked in some way by the form of the Trinity, these virtues, like the Trinity itself, are said to be related in the manner of a circular dance or perichoresis. Now, that's the only big theological word I'll be using tonight, but I notice that Dr. Ryan Messmore, the president of Campion College, is here, and I believe he actually wrote his doctoral dissertation on perichoresis in Trinitarian theology. So if you want to know more about perichoresis, you can speak to Dr. Messmore later on. But the general idea is that the theological virtues exist in a circular relationship. They are also related to the gifts of the Holy Spirit, with wisdom, understanding, and knowledge having a particular association with the theological virtue of faith, fortitude with the theological virtue of hope, and fear of the Lord and piety, or I think today it's called reverence. When I was confirmed, it was called piety, with the theological virtue of love. Pope Benedict issued three encyclicals in his pontificate. The first, Deus Caritas Est, was on the theological virtue of love. The second, Spes Salvi, was on the theological virtue of hope. And the third, Caritas in Veritate, was on the relationship between love and truth. There was, however, a fourth encyclical on the theological virtue of faith, which Pope Benedict drafted, but there was no time to publish it before the end of his pontificate. So Pope Francis took it up, made some of his own comments, and promulgated the encyclical under his own name as Lumen Fidei. So we now have a complete suite of papal encyclicals on the theological virtues. This trilogy of Pope Benedict and Pope Francis follows a similar trilogy by Blessed John Paul II. In the early years of his pontificate, Blessed John Paul II issued a suite of encyclicals on the relationship between the human person and each person of the Trinity. Redemptor Hominis covered the human person's relationship to Christ. Dives in Misericordia covered the human person's relationship to God the Father, and Dominum et Vivificantem covered the human person's relationship to God the Holy Spirit. If one takes the two suites of encyclicals, the first by Blessed John Paul II and the second by Benedict with a little help from Francis, what one has is the outline of a theological anthropology. That is an account of how the human person has been created in order to have a relationship with God. This field of theological anthropology is quite central to the work of the new evangelization, because what John Paul II and Benedict and now Francis have all understood is that what Christians are currently contending with is alternative humanisms. Alternative accounts of what it means to be a human being, which differ from the biblical notion that we are creatures made in the image and likeness of God. For example, in the 20th century, there was a Marxist anthropology, according to which the human being is defined by his or her relationship to the means of production that is defined by our position in the economic order, a kind of homo economicus. There is also the Freudian anthropology, according to which the human person is defined or is the subject of various emotional and predominantly sexual drives. And there was the Nazi anthropology with its emphasis on genetics and a view of the human person as a competitive animal, with some animals being more genetically predisposed to successful competition than others. In contemporary times, however, the most significant alternative humanism is derived from the ideas of the 19th century German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche argued that Christianity had killed Eros, that is to say, that Christianity was hostile to sexuality, and that Christian morality in general was a crime against life itself. Nietzsche divided people into two basic categories, members of the herd and the Übermensch, or superior people. Christianity, he argued, was the religion of the herd. In contemporary language, we might say that it represents the preferred moral code of nerds, you know, people without much personality. Nietzsche exhorted people to go to war against Christian morality in the name of humanity, and he represented what is often described as the nihilist wing of the German Romantic movement. Historians of ideas will explain that the German Romantic movement was a halfway house between nihilism on the one extreme and Catholicism on the other. And Nietzsche represents the extreme nihilist wing of the Romantic movement. The Romantics regarded self-realization, or what in German is called Bildung, B-I-L-D-U-N-G, as the highest good, the thing that human life is all about. They saw life as an artistic enterprise, and they wanted each and every life to have the properties of a great work of art, especially the quality of originality. Many wanted art to replace the traditional role of religion as the incentive and stimulus for human morality. They were interested in conceptions of truth, goodness, and beauty, or what are known in philosophy as the transcendentals. But most of them wanted to replace a Christian conception of these with neo-pagan conceptions. For many of the Romantics, Christian culture had proved to be disappointing. Their attitude to the theistic dimension in the culture of Christian Europe is well summarized in the following words of the German poet Heinrich Heine. Heine said, and in this paragraph, Heine gives a kind of intellectual history of theism. He says, "Our hearts are thrilled with compassion, for it is the old Jehovah himself who is making ready to die. We have known him so well, from his cradle in Egypt, where he was brought up among the divine crocodiles, the ibises, and the sacred cats. We saw him bid farewell to these companions of his childhood, the obelisks and the sphinxes of the Nile, to become a little god king in Palestine to a poor nation of shepherds. Later we saw him in contact with the Assyrio-Babylonian civilization. At this stage he gave up on his far too human passions and refrained from spitting wrath and vengeance. But then we saw him move to Rome, the capital, where he abjured everything in the way of national prejudice and proclaimed the celestial equality of all peoples. With these fine phrases he set up in opposition to the old Roman gods. He got into power, and from the heights of the capital of Rome he ruled the city and the world. We have seen him purify himself, spiritualize himself, become paternal, compassionate, the benefactor of the human race, indeed even a philanthropist. But nothing can save him. Don't you hear the bell? Get down on your knees. The sacrament is now being carried to a dying God. That was Heinrich Heine in 1834. This romantic movement reached the peak of its anti-Christian development in the works of Nietzsche. Nietzsche believed that Christianity, though on the wane in European culture, would continue to be influential unless and until scholars turned their attack on Christian ethics. Prior to Nietzsche, there had been a tendency for scholars to focus their criticisms on apparent scientific inaccuracies in the Bible, but they had never dared to attack Christian ethics. In 1888, Nietzsche wrote, "Up to the present, the assault against Christianity has not only been faint-hearted, it has been wide of the mark. So long as Christian ethics are not felt to be a capital crime against life itself, the defenders of Christianity will have the game in their hands. The problem of the truth of Christianity, the existence of the Christian God, to say nothing of Christian astronomy and natural science, is itself a very subsidiary problem, so long as the value of Christian ethics goes unquestioned." Okay, so that's Nietzsche in 1888. In the latter half of the 20th century, especially from the late 1960s onwards, this Nietzschean dream has been in the process of realization. Many people do now regard their lives as artistic enterprises, and they create for themselves their own moral principles without any reference to any deity. Often the reference points are popular magazines and the behavior of celebrities, and the Christian moral code is regarded as something so restrictive of human creativity as to be a bad or negative social element that should no longer be tolerated. So many practices regarded by Christians as evil are now regarded as essential elements in any package of human rights. This is an illustration of what Nietzsche called the project of the transvaluation of Christian values. His project was to make Christian morality look bad and practices that Christians regarded as bad look good. What John Paul II and Benedict understood was that Christians can't fight against this project by engaging in intellectual casuistry. There might be a place for that, but that alone is totally inadequate. What is at issue here is something so fundamental as the meaning and purpose of human life. And it is for this reason that they both spend so much time on anthropology. It is often said that John Paul II spent much of his life fighting what sociologists call the old left, that is, hardcore Marxist ideologues of the kind that oppressed the Russian and Central European peoples for a significant number of decades in the 20th century, while Benedict spent much of his time fighting the new left, whose natural habitat is not the trade union movement and other switch points of economic power, but the universities and other switch points of cultural power. The new left, unlike the old left, are more interested in sex than in economics. With their two suites of encyclicals, one on the Trinity and one on the theological virtues, Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict sought to offer an account of human life as a theodrama, where the actors are the three persons of the Trinity and the individual human person and his or her relationships with other human beings. In order to enter into this drama, the theological virtues are absolutely essential. Without faith or hope or love, it is impossible to be in a relationship with God at all. The idea of presenting human life as a theodrama comes from the 20th century Swiss theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar, who would be regarded by most commentators as one of the top three Catholic theologians of the 20th century, and certainly one of the most prolific. Balthasar strongly influenced the theology of both John Paul II and Benedict. He was an incredibly gifted son of a church architect who grew up in a family where they all spoke four modern languages, read Latin and classical Greek, and played several musical instruments. One of his uncles was Blessed Baron Vilmos ad Paul, a Hungarian bishop who protested against the persecution of the Hungarian Jews and who died a martyr's death in 1945 when he was trying to save women from being raped by drunken Soviet soldiers. Blessed Vilmos ad Paul, it almost goes without saying, was a member of the Order of Malta. Von Balthasar's sister Renee grew up to be a general of the Franciscan Order of Nuns. His mother ran the equivalent of the Catholic Women's League of Switzerland, and in previous generations his family had supplied the church with some outstanding military officers and Jesuit missionaries. When Blessed Karl of Austria, another member of the Order of Malta, was fleeing Austria with his family at the end of the First World War, it was von Balthasar's grandmother who put them up in Switzerland. In short, Balthasar was born into a family with enormous spiritual and cultural capital. As a young Jesuit seminarian, he was completely frustrated by his studies in the seminary, and he decided to take his doctorate in German literature, which he found to be more interesting. His doctoral dissertation was entitled The Apocalypse in the German Soul. It examined the treatment of death, judgment, heaven and hell in German literature from the period of Goethe up until the 20th century. One of Balthasar's conclusions was that the German intellectual elite of the 18th and 19th century had a choice between following Kant or following Goethe. So the two leading lights in the intellectual firmament of this period were Kant and Goethe. And Balthasar said they had a choice and the majority of them followed Kant. And he thinks that this was a major reason why the Germans were led into the disasters of World War I and II. But apart from that minor conclusion in his doctoral thesis, he also argued that a major problem with contemporary Western culture was that the transcendentals of the true, the beautiful, and the good had been separated from one another in the lives of individuals and in cultural practices. He believed that beauty was first severed from its relationship to the true and the good at the time of the Reformation. Many of the Protestants had a problem with beauty and regarded it as a Platonic concept that got incorporated into the Christian tradition via Saint Augustine and was thus one of those Greek ideas from which Christianity needed to be purified. The end result was Puritanism and ultimately Jansenism at one end of the spectrum, and the Catholic culture of the Baroque and Rococo at the other. Von Balthasar then traced the severance of the true from the good from the 18th century onwards. He believed that in the present world it is easier to convert people through an experience of beauty and love than by having long intellectual conversations with them about matters of philosophy. He's not saying that kind of intellectual work in the area of philosophy is unimportant, but he thought that when dealing with people outside the academy, the best approach was through the transcendental of beauty. In his work, Love Alone is Credible, he argued this point. While von Balthasar worked on the problem of the severance of truth, beauty, and goodness in contemporary Western culture, a German philosopher called Joseph Pieper worked on the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love. Pieper noted that just as truth, beauty, and goodness had been severed from their perichoretic or circular relationship to one another, so too had the theological virtues. And once severed, they underwent a kind of secular mutation. Faith became mutated. Instead of being faith in God, it became faith in science. Hope, instead of being hope in the resurrection and eternal life, became hope in human progress. And love started to lose its multi-dimensional complexity and became truncated to mere eros. Ratzinger admired Pieper when he was a student, and they later became friends. In 1974, Joseph Pieper wrote to Ratzinger and told him that he should get in touch with the then Archbishop of Krakow, Cardinal Wojtyła. Pieper had heard Wojtyła speak at a philosophy conference, and he thought that Wojtyła and Ratzinger should get to know one another. Ratzinger sent Wojtyła a copy of his book Introduction to Christianity, and then 2 years later in 1976, when Cardinal Wojtyła was invited to preach the Lenten retreat to Pope Paul VI, he based the retreat on ideas found in Ratzinger's Introduction to Christianity. And then, of course, 2 years later, when Cardinal Wojtyła becomes the Pope, who does he invite to Rome to be his prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith but Joseph Ratzinger? And the whole 25 or 27 year partnership between Wojtyła and Ratzinger, Wojtyła as Pope, Ratzinger as the prefect for the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, goes back simply to Joseph Pieper. You know, this German philosopher hearing Wojtyła speak and thinking, you and Ratzinger should get together. So when we approach Pope Benedict's encyclicals, Deus Caritas Est on the theological virtue of love, and Spes Salvi on the theological virtue of hope, it helps to have this background knowledge about the contributions of Pieper and von Balthasar. Benedict's first encyclical reads like a fireside chat, an after-dinner conversation between a very paternal professor and his much-loved students. One of the key sentences of the entire work appears in paragraph 14. Benedict states that faith, worship, and ethos are interwoven as a single reality that takes shape in our encounter with God's agape. The usual contraposition between worship and ethics, as though these are two completely separate things, falls apart. Benedict says that worship itself, Eucharistic communion, includes the reality both of being loved and of loving others in return. The tendency to view ethics as something unrelated to worship has been a common error, or had been a common error, in Catholic catechetics for several generations. The problem was teaching these things as though they had no relationship to each other. Another Swiss Jesuit theologian, Peter Henrici, who was a cousin of von Balthasar, summed up the problem in his statement that for many people, and he's talking mainly prior to the Second Vatican Council, Christian existence had become viewed as a meritorious achievement that God commands and by virtue of which one is able to please him. Or in other words, that Immanuel Kant had become a secret father of the church. One of Kant's projects was to sever the ethical component from Christianity, from other components of the package. Christianity, according to Henrici, had been reduced in the minds of many people to a mere ethical framework, or what they called a moralism. So in the first section of the encyclical, there is a swipe at moralism. There is a criticism of the treatment or the presentation of the Christian faith as merely a moral framework. Of course, Christianity does have a moral framework, and Pope Benedict's not denying that. But he is making the point that it's so much more than a moral code. And people like Kant, who want to emphasize the moral code dimension, he thinks have done Christianity a great disservice and have given rise to this mentality, which is common in the population, that Christianity is just a moral code of a whole range of things that people are not allowed to do, which fetters their exercise of their human freedom. So the first part of Deus Caritas Est reiterates many things in von Balthasar's short book, Love Alone is Credible, and in the Nuptial Mystery Theology of Cardinal Angelo Scola and Cardinal Marc Ouellette, who were both regarded by the press as hot contenders in the last papal conclave. For example, both Ouellette and Scola emphasise that the Christian experience of the faith is nuptial. They actually use the word nuptial, meaning, you know, that there is a spousal relationship. Revelation is a love story between God and the human person. And here again, there is this notion of the human person being engaged in a theodrama. In the very first paragraph, Benedict states that being a Christian is not the result of an ethical choice, but it's an encounter with an event and indeed with a person. Similarly, Cardinal Ouellette has written that the foundation of ethical thought is nothing less than the Trinitarian horizon of human existence. And once ethics is placed within such an horizon, the walls between worship and ethics fall down and people start to see the relationship between liturgy and ethics, between having a personal relationship with each of the persons of the Trinity and ethics. In his work Augustine and Modernity, Michael Hanby, who is an American theologian, argued that at issue within the culture of modernity is the Trinity itself, and specifically whether the meaning of human nature is understood to occur within Christ's mediation of the love and delight shared as a gift between God the Father and God the Son, or beyond it. In other words, can we understand human nature without the Trinity? He further suggested that one of the many errors of the Pelagians was precisely that they attempted to create possibilities for human nature outside the Trinity and outside of Christ's mediation. In the first half of the encyclical, Benedict tries to restore these broken links between the human will and the love between the persons of the Trinity and the human person. He reminds the world that God himself is love, and he often makes the point that no other religion has a God who is love. There are other gods, and all the other religions have different accounts of their gods, but the Christian tradition is the only one for whom God is love. So he reminds the world that God is love, that ethics is about relationships with other persons, that worship and ethics are both about love, and that while there is no such thing as love without responsibility or without duty, Christians shouldn't reduce love to duty. There is something much more intoxicating and chivalrous about Christian love than anything to be found in a manual of ethics. Implicit in all that is said in the first half of the encyclical is that those who think that Christian ethics is all about duty and casuistry have got it wrong. And in particular, those who try to understand sexuality in terms of casuistry are missing the big picture. They don't understand sexuality because they don't understand love, and they don't understand love because they don't understand God. It is as if Benedict is trying to go back to basics so that people can remember what the big picture was, or get a vision of it for the first time, and then situate the moral theology developed by his predecessor, Pope John Paul II, within it. In particular, Benedict develops a response to the Nietzschean claim that Christianity has killed Eros by taking the view that Eros and Agape, in other words, erotic love and high-minded philanthropic love, need one another or are symbiotically dependent on one another, that we don't have to choose between a high-minded Agape and a low-minded Eros, But both Eros and Agape need to be purified and perfected by one another. The second half of the encyclical reiterates the social teaching of John Paul II and reminds Catholics that they are their brother's keepers, that a civilization of love can only be built upon institutional structures which foster justice in human relationships. In this section of the encyclical, there is nothing particularly new, but the juxtaposition of the two sections within the one encyclical may help to overcome the tendency in some parts of the Church for individuals to divide themselves into groups concerned solely with issues of private morality or issues of social justice. In fact, there is no such thing as really private morality because all of our actions have a communal consequence. At the very start of the second part of the encyclical, Benedict makes it clear that the Church's charitable activity is no optional extra, but something as fundamental as, quote, a manifestation of Trinitarian love. So when we go about handing out blankets to people in parks in the middle of winter, we're actually, according to Benedict, we are engaged in something as fundamental as the manifestation of Trinitarian love. However, it is interesting to note that just as in the first section, Benedict is keen to emphasise that Christianity is not a mere ethical framework. In the second section, he is keen to emphasise that Christian charity is essentially different from other forms of social welfare. He observes that while professional competence is a fundamental requirement of the work of Christians in charitable institutions, we can't be running hospitals with incompetent doctors or nurses. Professional competence is not alone sufficient. Christian love should transform the very ethos, the fundamental practices of Christian institutions. In practice, this means that Catholic schools should not be like government schools with an extra class called religious education and an occasional crucifix in the corner, and Catholic hospitals should not be just like government-sponsored hospitals with the occasional crucifix, statue of a saint, or prayer room added. This is because Christian love, if authentic, should change the entire ethos of the institution. It should permeate every layer of the culture. It should affect every practice of the institution. So that's an overview of Deus Caritas Est, Pope Benedict's encyclical on the theological virtue of love. We now come to the second encyclical, Spes Salvi. Central to Pope Benedict's reading of the state of the theological virtue of hope is the notion that since the time of the French Revolution, the Christian understanding of hope has been mutated into liberal and then Marxist and finally social Darwinist notions of progress. He came to this judgment in the 1970s when reading the three-volume work of Ernest Bloch called The Principle of Hope, which he believed exemplified the mutation. Ratzinger concluded that both the liberal and the Marxist image of the world share a strange eschatological consciousness ultimately shaped by the idea of progress. He describes the liberal faith in continuous progress as the bourgeois substitute for the lost hope of faith and the replacement of the concept of truth by the concept of progress as the neuralgic point of the modern age. He suggests that liberalism and 18th century philosophy associated with the various enlightenments want to talk us into accepting a world without fear. They promise the complete elimination of every kind of fear through the application of so-called scientific rationality. In a series of essays published as Values in a Time of Upheaval in 2005, Ratzinger further traced the transition from the mutations in the concept of God in the 18th century, from God, the Christian creator, to God, the mechanic, to a second enlightenment, which renders all conceptions of God and even of Marxist eschatology obsolete. It takes as its criterion of rationality the experience of technological production based on science. This more contemporary mutation markets itself under the label of a new world order. Ratzinger observes that proponents of this concept share with Marxism the evolutionistic idea that the world we encounter is the product of irrational choice, and that it cannot bear any ethical directives in itself, as the old idea of nature envisaged. In other words, many contemporary philosophers no longer believe that there is such a thing as human nature. They don't believe that there is a human nature. They believe that we are in a process of evolutionary development, and what we are today may not be what we are tomorrow. The principles of this new order are therefore not derived from considerations of what is according to nature, in other words, the natural law is totally defunct, but from the dreams of scientific and entrepreneurial elites who represent a new ruling class and bring with them new forms of coercion. The greatest scope for their operation lies in the fields of biotechnology. Human life becomes a product, and hope is reduced to something like trust in the future promises of genetic manipulation. And just today, when I was flying up from Melbourne, in the Qantas handbook, that's placed in all the seats in the aeroplane, there's a whole article on how in the future we might be able to take drugs which stop the aging process, and we'll all be able to live much longer. Now, perhaps that will happen, I don't know, but the point that Ratzinger is making is that instead of people hoping in Christ and eternal salvation, many people are now placing their hope in technology and living in fear of death and hoping that things like technological developments will solve their problems. Contrary to all conceptions of rationality which seek to isolate themselves from faith, in paragraph 23 of Spes Salvi, Pope Benedict reiterates his often repeated statement that reason needs faith if it is to be completely itself. Reason and faith need one another in order to fulfill their true mission. In his year 2000 address to the professors of the Sorbonne University, and here I think it's significant to note that Ratzinger was actually a member of the Académie Française in the division of the social and political sciences. And in France, there is nothing higher than being a member of the Académie Française. So the fact that Ratzinger, when he was a cardinal, was appointed to this incredibly honorific position says a great deal about the scholarship of Joseph Ratzinger and his standing in the world of European letters. So in the year 2000, at the Sorbonne University, they had a symposium to celebrate the millennium. Now, the Sorbonne is obviously not a very Catholic place these days, but they did invite Ratzinger. And in that address, he noted that in the conception of early Christianity, the notions of human nature, of God, and religion were inextricably linked to one another, and that precisely this bond helped Christianity to navigate itself amidst the crisis of ancient rationality. He suggested that the links or intellectual glue uniting these various notions, the relationship of human nature, God, ethos, and religion, have in successive centuries been detached, or as Alistair MacIntyre argues, they've been severed, the relationships with each of these concepts, the way that they initially existed in a relationship with one another in early Christian thought has been severed. So people no longer know, for example, how human nature is meant to relate to God's nature. If you go out into the public and ask people how they think that relationship is meant to work, between God and a human person. They've got no idea. Ratzinger believes that a restoration of these links is a necessary component of the work of evangelization, and that one of the most important patristic insights or insights of the early church fathers, which requires restoration today, is the notion that within the ordering of religion to a rational view of reality, the primacy of the Logos and the primacy of love were revealed to be one and the same. He often expresses this by saying, love and reason are the twin pillars of all reality. And this link between love and reason is a strong motif in von Balthasar's book, A Theological Anthropology, which is a work praised by Ratzinger. In that work, von Balthasar said, such unity of the Christian attitude of faith, hope, and love is the ultimate basis of the Christian understanding or knowledge, whose nearest analogy is the knowledge of a beloved human being. In other words, we only know our spouses insofar as we love our spouses. If we think about our relationships with our spouses, or if we're not married, if we think about our relationships with our siblings or our parents or other people we love, there is an intimate link between our knowledge of those people and our love of those people. So Benedict wants people to understand this link between love and knowledge. And Balthasar says, and of course this is just basic Christianity, that the mediator of such understanding in love is the Holy Spirit, who, as the spirit of childhood, encourages two attitudes. The first is the immediate open approach to all the treasures and secrets of God. And the second is a childlike spirit, which does not presume to take what does not belong to it. In other words, that we need to understand that truth is something we receive. It's not something we go out and grasp. When the theological virtue of hope is weak or mutated, two spiritual pathologies arise. And Ratzinger has labelled these pious Pelagianism and bourgeois Pelagianism. He says the pious Pelagians think of life as something like taking out an insurance policy against spending eternity in hell. He says by means of a tough and rigorous system of religious practices, by means of various prayers and actions, they want to create for themselves a right to blessedness. Sort of like the CV approach to your relationship with God. What they lack is the humility essential to any love. The humility to be able to receive what we are given over and above what we have deserved and achieved. He says this kind of Pelagianism is thus an apostasy from love and also from hope, and at the profoundest level from faith as well. That the core of Pelagianism is a religion without love. While the pious Pelagians err by focusing on their own salvation and turning it into a project to be realized by a strategic plan, which once enacted should evoke a predictable reward from God, others can err in the opposite direction. They want to believe that there are no eternal consequences of our life choices here and now, and that everyone is guaranteed an entry ticket to an egalitarian heaven where it does not matter what one has made of the gift of life on earth. Against this form of Pelagianism, Benedict says, grace does not cancel out justice. It cannot make right wrong into right. It is not a sponge which wipes everything away. Dostoevsky, the Russian novelist, was right to protest against this kind of heaven. Evildoers do not sit at the table at the eternal banquet beside their victims without distinction, as though nothing has happened. He says, for the bourgeois Pelagians, they tend to have the attitude that if God really does exist, And if he does in fact bother about people, he cannot be so fearfully demanding as he is described by the faith of the church. Here his use of bourgeois should not be construed to mean middle class, but rather having a preference for that which will get one by, rather than striving for excellence. A number of European sociologists have used the expression in this way, and they argue that Protestant cultures tend to be bourgeois, while Catholic cultures tend to be erotic and aristocratic. Here, erotic does not mean explicitly sexual, but rather passionate or driven by ideals. The bourgeois personality type makes do with what is serviceable and is content to just get across the line, while the aristocratic personality type always wants to be the best. These terms are used by sociologists, so that the bourgeois type just wants to know what is the least amount of work I have to do to get my nose across the line, whereas the aristocratic personality type wants to strive for excellence. And sociologists, indeed some who are not even Catholic, have argued that Protestant cultures have this tendency to be more bourgeois, and that the Catholic cultures have a tendency to be more erotic or aristocratic. The corrosive effect of the bourgeois mentality on Catholic spirituality and the theological virtue of hope was a recurring theme in the novels of the French writer Georges Bernano, who influenced von Balthasar. One example of his treatment of this theme comes in the book We the French. This is what he says. There exists a Christian order. This order is the order of Christ, and the Catholic tradition has preserved its essential principles. But the temporal realization of this order does not belong to the theologians, but to us ordinary Christians. And it seems that the majority of Christians are forgetting this elementary truth. They believe that the kingdom of God will happen all by itself, providing they obey the moral rules, which in any event are common to all decent people, abstain from working on Sunday, that is, if their business doesn't suffer too much for it, attend a mass on the same day, and above all, pay great respect to clerics. This would be tantamount to saying that in times of war, an army could quite fulfil the nation's expectations if its men were squeaky clean, if they marched in step behind the band, and if they saluted their officers correctly. Okay, that's Bernanos being critical of this bourgeois mentality. Implicit within the mentality of the bourgeois Pelagian is a form of trust in the liberal notion of progress. And Ratzinger has consistently rejected all the versions of belief in cumulative progress. In paragraph 24 of Space Selvi, he wrote, "Let us ask once again, in what may we hope and in what may we not hope? First of all, we must acknowledge that incremental progress is possible only in the material sphere. Here, amid our growing knowledge of the structure of matter and in the light of ever more advanced inventions, we clearly see continuous progress being made over the mastery of nature. Yet in the field of ethical awareness, there is no similar possibility of accumulation, for the simple reason that human freedom is always new and must always make decisions anew. New generations can build on the knowledge and experience of those who went before, but they can also reject that knowledge and experience. The moral treasury of humanity is not readily at hand like tools that we use." Much of the above can be succinctly summarized in Joseph Pieper's statement that the classical theology of the Church is equally removed from both the oversimplification of liberalism and the desperate rigidity of Stoicism. Finally, we come to the theological virtue of faith and its treatment in Lumen Fidei, the first encyclical of the pontificate of Pope Francis. The first three chapters of this encyclical read as Vintage Benedict. One of the gifts that he brought to the papacy was an extensive knowledge of the history of ideas, and in particular a deep knowledge of German philosophy. As Kant is a key to deciphering the culture of modernity, Nietzsche is the Rosetta Stone for postmodernity. Kant gave us the quest for autonomous reason, severed from theological presuppositions. And Nietzsche gave us the critique of Christianity as an oppressive straitjacket whose moral compass is fit only for members of the herd. Much of the encyclical is a broadside against these German contributions to world history and their sidelining of the theological virtue of faith. Both Benedict and Francis measure the light of autonomous human reason against the light of faith and find it wanting. As far back as 1969, the young Father Ratzinger wrote that the organ by which God can be seen cannot be a non-historical natural reason, which just does not exist, but only a purified reason, or as Augustine expresses it, a pure heart. At this time, he also remarked that the necessary purification of sight takes place through faith and through love, and at all events, not as a result of human reflection alone, and not at all by man's own power. What he's doing there is attacking the whole Enlightenment notion of reason and juxtaposing it with an account of the relationship between faith and reason, which is strongly Augustinian. In Lumen Fide, the further point is made that faith is not a private matter. It is a necessarily communal, and in particular, it's an ecclesial matter. No one can baptize himself. In this context, reference is given to the ideas of Romano Guardini, who was a professor at the University of Munich in the years 1948 to 1962, and one of the intellectual heroes of Ratzinger's generation of German seminarians. He was one of those who were not allowed to teach during the whole of the Nazi period. Since faith illumines reason, the relationship between the two is not, as Kant would have it, extrinsic, that is, completely unrelated one to the other. Those who prefer to read the relationship extrinsically often have a recourse to the document De Filiis of Vatican I. But as Gregory Baum of McGill University has argued, De Filiis did not address the issue of how knowledge of God based on human reason is related to the saving actions of God revealed in Christ. However, the profounder understanding of revelation offered in the document De Verbum at the Second Vatican Council introduces a new theological epistemology. Baum summarizes this in the following paragraph. Vatican I affirms that God, the beginning and end of all things, can be known with certainty from created reality by the light of human reason. In accordance with Vatican II, we can now say that if God allows himself to be found across whatever distance through the works of his creation as understood by human reason, this does not take place because of an independent or sovereign act of the human person, but rather because of the appeal which the gracious God, through his creation, makes to the mind and the heart of men. The natural knowledge of God is related to the history of salvation, appointed for the whole human family, which is revealed once and for all in Jesus Christ. This criticism of the idea of reason as an independent and sovereign act of the human person that must be kept uncontaminated by the theological virtue of faith is a central theme of the encyclical. In short, you can say the encyclical is, you know, a full frontal attack on the Kantian notion of rationality. Another of the young Ratzinger's intellectual heroes was the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber. Lumen Fide endorses Buber's critique of idolatry. In paragraph 13, we find the statement, Once man has lost the fundamental orientation which unifies his existence, he breaks down into a myriad of unconnected instants. As such, idolatry does not offer a journey, but rather a plethora of paths leading nowhere and forming a vast labyrinth. It turns people into narrative wrecks. Their lifestyles lack coherence. There is no inner logic, just numerous experiences without any overarching purpose. The Nietzschean dream of creating a totally original self ends in tragedy, as the gifts of the creator, including the gift of time itself, are dissipated in social experiments, leading nowhere in particular. In contrast, the light of faith draws together the various dimensions of human existence into a coherent whole. The light of faith is capable of illuminating every aspect of human existence. Lumen Fidei also emphasizes the importance of the faith and memory relationship. The faculty of the memory, which is very important in Augustinian anthropology, was often neglected by scholars focused on defending the faith at the bar of Kantian rationality. In Lumen Fidei, the sacraments are said to communicate an incarnate memory linked to the times and places of our lives, linked to all of our senses. In them, the whole person is engaged as part of a network of communitarian relationships, including, of course, the relationships with each of the persons of the Trinity. The fourth chapter of Lumen Fidei links the theological virtue of faith to the common good, including the good of family life. Its tone is more direct, and its message is about the pastoral applications of the theology outlined in the previous paragraphs. The tone sounds more like Pope Francis than Pope Benedict, and it is in this section that St. Francis receives an honourable mention. One senses that the difference between the two pontiffs is not a matter of theology, but of personal style, temperament, and skills. Benedict is the scholar's scholar, while Francis is more interested in the practical pastoral applications of the scholarship. How does a better understanding of the theological virtues help the man or woman on the Coogee Beach bus? This would appear to be the Franciscan focus, fortified by Benedictine learning. In conclusion, one can say that if we read the encyclicals of John Paul II and Benedict and Francis on the Trinity and on the theological virtues, one can find an analysis of the Church's contemporary predicament within Western culture. Specifically, what we find is something like a pathology report on how the transcendentals of truth, beauty, and goodness became severed from one another in their embodiment within our cultural practices, and how the meaning of the theological virtues became mutated, so that faith became mutated into scientific reason, hope became hope in scientific research, particularly medical progress, and love became so profoundly misunderstood that people felt as though they had to choose between Puritanism and agape on the one side or eros on the other, without any hope of any proper synthesis of eros and agape. What this paper is merely a bird's eye view of the territory. The territory covered in the last 25 pages is usually covered over 36 hours in one of the subjects I teach at the John Paul II Institute. I apologise for the fact that it has been so broad brush, but I hope that in giving you at least a snapshot of the territory, that you will have learned something of value to you personally, and that you will have a deeper understanding of why Pope Benedict spent so much time trying to explain to people the significance of the theological virtues. Thank you.
That was Professor Tracy Rowland with Repairing Faith, Hope and Love, This talk was part of the Order of Malta lecture series, organised by the Australian Association of the Order of Malta. And for more talks, shows, and interviews, visit cradio.org.au.